some serious calculation by not just explaining an abstract formalism, but trying to do calculation of actual physical quantities, things you can relate to physical problems for the free field. So remember, what we quantize by functional integral, the scalar free field. And so first, I will recall what is a functional integral for this, which allows to quantize this field by functional integral methods. And I will do this in particular by explaining how in Euclidean time. And one reason for that is that it will show you the connection between quantum field theory and statistical mechanics. And also, and that's also related to that, because I will show you how to discretize, transform space-time discretization on a lattice, both because it allows to define precisely what the functional integral is, and second, it shows explicitly the connection with the problem of statistical mechanics. And then I will show you how to compute some correlation functions, namely some matrix element of operators. And in particular, show you how you can recover Wieck theorem in a very fast way using the formalism of functional integration. So first, let us define the scalar free field in Euclidean space time. So there is no time anymore. And remember, so we have space is just the space, the position vector is just d-dimensional vector, space is R to the power D, so D is the dimension of Euclidean spacetime, and we have a field phi, a scalar field, which is a real, which depends on X, the position in space. So now, in order to make things simpler, I will define that spacetime is, in fact, instead of S pi, of being infinite, I will put it as a torus. So I will introduce a finite space and Euclidean time. Namely, instead of taking the Euclidean space, I will take a box. So I will take a box where here is Euclidean time, tau. So this is just the first dimension, the first vector of X. So X is the dimensional vector X0 up to X D minus 1. So this is the Euclidean time, and the remaining are the space coordinates. And so this is the time. This is space, X. Here I draw a picture of space-time just in 1 plus 1 dimension because it's simpler. And I introduced boundary conditions. So I consider that this is a box. So this is a box, a square, of size. So I will introduce here a size which is, let us call it T. T will be the period. And the size in the X direction will be L. Okay. And I introduce, both for simplicity and for the physics, I introduced periodic boundary condition. So it means that the value of the field here is the same than here, and the value of the field here is the same than here. So in fact, space-time is a torus. We have torus. a d-dimensional torus. Yes?
You said t is the time length of the box.
Yes.
And you used capital T. Should I think of that as being completely separate of the temperature?
Yeah. It's OK. So you are right. It's those notation might be misleading. So let me call this P. So P is a period. So I have a. So P is a Euclidean time period, and L is the size of a space. In fact, you see, so you have a field which lives in a box, which is a torus of size L, and it's defined in addition in Euclidean time with periodic boundary condition. So this system will describe, in fact, a field, quantum field, in a torus, in a special torus of size L. And since we are considering that time is Euclidean and is periodic, we are considering that this quantum field is at equilibrium at the temperature T. And remember, what is the relation between T and the period? The period is h bar over kBT. So the field is in a Gibbs state at the temperature T. And the larger P, the smaller the temperature, and the smaller the period, the larger the temperature. OK? You just apply the rules that we dealt yesterday, defined yesterday. OK? And so now we know that the action, so we have to, in order to quantize this field using functional integral method, we have to use the Euclidean action. And the Euclidean action, remember, is just, so it's the integral over this box, dd of x. So this is over this box, this torus, which is now space-time, of 1/2 of d mu phi d mu phi. I'm summing over repeated indices. And I don't have to care whether the indices are up or down because I am in Euclidean space. Plus m squared over 2 phi squared. OK? So this is the action of a field configuration. OK? And I have to define something which is, for instance, a partition function, which is a functional integral over this field of exponential minus 1 over h bar SE of phi. Okay? And we know that this is this functional integral. Try to compute, gives you the partition function of the system at temperature. So it gives you the trace of E minus beta H, where H is the Hamiltonian of the free field, and beta is 1 over kBT. The standard factor of thermodynamics. OK? So now I want to define that properly. And in order to define this properly, I will discretize space-time. Here it's Euclidean space-time. By simply, instead of having this is tau, this is x. Instead of having a continuum space-time, I introduce both a discretization of time So instead of having continuous time, Euclidean time, I introduce a discretization of time. So, and so therefore, instead of having tau, I said that tau is replaced by some tau I equal delta t tau times I, where I is an integer. And it goes from 0 to, of course, some p over delta tau minus 1, because I am using periodic boundary condition. But if time was infinite, it would be an integer. And now I discretize also space, because it makes that my quantum field now becomes just a standard quantum mechanical system. I have a finite number of degrees of freedom. So instead of having a continuous space, I introduce a continuous time, a discrete time, so which means that the space coordinates are replaced by some x, let us call it g, equal delta x times g, where g is an integer vector. It means that it's a vector, g1 up to gd minus 1, where those g mu, let's say, goes from 0 up to, of course, L divided by delta x, since I am using the I have a finite space, okay? And therefore, which means now at each point of this, now space is continuous, here space is a lattice, okay? And to define what the functional integral is, I associate to each point here. So let me call the capital I. So let me call capital I, the d component integer vector, a form of just the first integer which labels the position in time, and the vector which labels the position in space. Okay? So I denote this by a big capital I, let us put a vector in order to remember that it is a vector. And therefore, this means that instead of considering that the scalar field is a function of space, here, I have an x here, it's a collection of phi I, where I labels a point on a lattice. And therefore, what I am to do when I'm doing that is that in order to define what is the partition function for this discretized model, well, it's very simple. I have to replace the formal measure integral over all the position of the field by something which is a product of all the I in the lattice of d phi I. There is a normalization factor that I will write later, and then I have exponential of minus some SE discretized of phi. Okay. So what I have to do, so now I am integrating over a finite number of variables, the value of the field at any point, I on the lattice. So it's a well-defined integral. But I have to discretize the action. So what is this discretized action? There is a natural Euclidean discretized action. Well, it's easy. In the action, you just have to replace the integral over the integral over space-time by a sum over the points. So you sum over the i's. And now it is a finite sum. Now, of course, I have to replace the dV of x by the volume element for the point in the lattice. So this volume element is obviously delta 2 times delta x to the power d minus 1. Okay. And then I have to replace the derivative by finite difference. So I have to replace d mu of I of x by the finite difference, which is obviously phi of, let me write this by delta 2 e mu. So if I write x still a vector, x by xi, so I claim that I replace x by xi, which is the position of the point on the lattice. So this is replaced by phi of x plus delta t e mu minus phi of x divided by delta tau if this is the first derivative. And the same thing for this is d0, and the same thing for d mu of phi of x if I am in the x direction. Divided by delta x, where of course e mu is a unit vector in direction mu. So this is e zero, and this is e mu in the space direction. Okay. This I can. So I have to replace this by this. And for simplicity, in fact, up to now, I will consider that delta tau is equal to delta x because it makes things simpler. So I can replace this by. Where are they? Okay. So this is just, let us say, delta x to the power d, if I have this choice. And then I have phi of x plus delta x e mu minus phi of x squared divided by delta x squared. And I am summing, let me. From mu equals 0 to d minus 1. Here I represent. So this is the first term. And I have, of course, a factor of 1/2. And then the second term is just the sum of the value of m squared over 2 times phi of x squared. And here I specify that this is x at the position I. Do you see? So. The functional integral is now an integral over a finite number of variables, very large but finite. The action is discretized, so it's a sum of a term which involves the value of the field at any point on the lattice. And this is a term which involves the difference, the derivative, the difference between the value of the field at two neighboring points, both in the space and in the time direction of phi. So here I have the sum over the sides, and here this corresponds to a sum over the links, if you want. And that's a perfectly well-defined integral. See how it works? Yes?
In the partition function, should there be a Planck factor in the exponent?
Should there be a?
In the partition function, should there be a Planck factor?
What? Sorry?
Should there be an H bar?
Oh, yes, of course. Yes. Yes. It's just a normalization. At that stage, it's a normalization, but it's a, yes. Okay. So, and you see immediately that this partition function, which is a discretized version of the partition function for a quantum system. The quantum system is a quantum field, scalar field. It's very, very similar, mathematically, the same thing that this Z for the quantum field, so this Z discretized. Okay, it's very, very similar, so in fact, it can be identified with a partition function. Or an ensemble of spins, of classical spins, on a lattice, because this action SE discretized can be written simply as a sum of the links IG of the lattice of phi I minus phi G squared divided by delta X to the power 2 minus D, 1/2. Plus sum over the sides of the lattice, I of m squared over 2, delta x to the power d, phi r squared. Yes?
What do you mean by classical here?
Classical means that this, the spin, instead of being, as in the Ising model, where you have a spin si which go take the value plus or minus 1. Here, I have a continuous spin, phi I, which goes from minus infinity to plus infinity. It can take any value between plus infinity and minus infinity. But still, it's a classical spin. It's a classical spin because it's a real variable. In both cases, this is a real variable. So we are, yes?
So here we have a quantized field, and then we also quantize our space-time. Does one dependence on the other? Do we have to quantize space-time?
No, no, I'm not quantizing space-time.
I mean, okay, sorry, not quantizing, discretizing.
Pardon?
Discretizing.
No, I am discretizing for two reasons, I explain you. First, it's a way to define properly the functional integral, when one is sure that everything is finite, we have no subtle problem. And so this was the first reason. The second reason is that this shows that this problem, once you discretize it, is equivalent to a problem of statistical mechanics.
Okay.
So it makes the connection.
Yeah.
Yes?
So it's not because the field itself is quantized. Like that has nothing to do.
Well, it's required to some extent to do that if you want to define properly the quantized field for the following reason. It's not because space-time is discretized. We don't believe that unless we go to some theory of quantum gravity where perhaps space-time is discrete, but it's probably something much more complicated than such, just a lattice. Because doing that, you get rid of short-distance singularities and divergence that I will discuss later. Okay. That's just for this reason.
Okay, so it has nothing to do with the field itself being quantized.
No, but as we shall see, since the field is quantized, there are short distance and high energy singularities, and therefore one way to understand those is to discretize space-time and then go to the continuum. Okay? So you see, to go back.
Excuse me?
Yes, oh, sorry, you had a question? Yes.
that expression, the bottom expression for the discretized Euclidean action?
Yes.
In the first sum, you have in the numerator phi I minus phi I.
No, because you are summing, you have phi I. No, phi I minus phi I is zero.
Right.
Oh, I am sorry. This is phi I minus phi G, of course. Yes. Thank you. Yes?
Would you mind explaining what phi I is for the...
Well, what I mean is that this action has the same form as the energy for the Ising model, except that in the Ising model, phi is replaced by a variable which is called S. But it's just a denomination. I mean that in this action, phi plays the same role than Si in the Ising model. You see, in the Ising model, but I think you have studied the Ising model in detail with John Berlinski. You have an energy functional, which is minus g sum over the links ij of si sg. And since si is equal to plus or minus 1, you can add to this an minus 1 half plus 1 half. Minus 1. So square over 2, which is always 1, plus 1. And rewrite this as g times sum over the links ij of your lattice of si minus hg squared plus this one, which is just a constant. It's minus g times the number of spins. With just a constant. So you see that these terms in the Ising coupling of the Ising model looks like this one with the coupling constant of the Ising model here being 1 over 2 delta x 2 minus d and h bar, prefer. But the big difference is that in the Ising model, the spin takes two values plus or minus 1, while in this model, the value of these continuous spins goes from minus infinity to plus infinity. So it's the physics of this model is very, very, very different. This model has, for instance, no phase transition, while the Ising model has a phase transition. Okay. So you see the link here between the quantum field theory and a statistical model. And you will see some application of this idea viewed from the point of view of statistical physics in the lecture by John Berlinski. Okay? So now let us come back to quantum field theory. So now, of course, this discretization has been introduced here for convenience and for some reason that I will explain later. Yes?
Why should we be comparing the partition function of the quantum field theory to the Hamiltonian of the Ising model? It is the partition function that we're comparing to the Hamiltonian rather than partition.
Well,
it looks like we're comparing action to Hamiltonian.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But that's precisely what it is. The point is that if you take, you see here on a very simple example that I take a quantum field theory here, which is a free field, in 1 plus d minus 1 dimension. Okay? And this quantum field theory is governed by an action S of phi. This is action. Okay? I go to Euclidean time. Then I have an Euclidean quantum field theory, let us call it EQFT, in D dimensions, okay, and with an action which is an Euclidean action SE of phi. And what we see on this example is that this problem is equivalent, well, if you introduce some discretization, to a problem of equilibrium statistical mechanics for a system which lives on a d-dimensional lattice. Okay? And it's Hamiltonian, or if you prefer, the energy of a microstate, a microscopic configuration, H. So I have a d-dimensional lattice. I have an order parameter, which is the analog of phi, but it's belongs to the lattice. And this Hamiltonian, this energy functional for phi, in fact, is analog to this one. So I have a mapping between the energy functional for a microstate in this equilibrium statistical mechanics and the Euclidean action of this quantum field theory in D. In a d-dimensional space-time, which itself is derived from the action of the real quantum field theory in one dimension of time and d minus one dimension of space. You see? So for instance, if I consider a quantum field theory in one dimension of space and one dimension of time, I expect there will be some mapping into a statistical mechanical problem in two dimensions. Not in one dimension, but in two dimensions. Yes?
Is this correspondence only mathematical?
What do you mean by only mathematical?
So if we have done all this math and we show that there's the correspondence between partition function and the integral of the action as integral, well, it's quite okay, but I mean, what's the deep reason? Well, can write a quantum field theory in equilibrium
statistical mechanics. I think the deep reason is mathematical, I would say. It's because the functional integral takes exactly the same form. So you have the same mathematical object which can be used in two different contexts. One is statistical mechanics, one is quantum field theory.
Quite different, right?
Yes, but it happens that these relations make that you can map some problem of statistical mechanics into some problem of quantum field theory, and some problem of quantum field theory into some problem of statistical mechanics.
What I want to ask you is there something behind that, something deep behind that?
I think that, as far as I understood, the deep reason is the mass of quantum mechanics, the mathematics of quantum mechanics. For a more physical reason, I don't really know. But if you consider that masses are something deep, and mass are only something deep in quantum mechanics, quantum mechanics is very rigid because the mass are very, very deep. I can say. Yes?
When we discretize to make a lattice, is there any relationship between delta x or delta tau and h bar?
No. It's something completely different. H-bar is a quantum of action. This is a discretization which tells you, OK, I consider that my space and my time at some very tiny domain region becomes small. But it's at that level, it's a mathematical trick to make the mapping. You know, the only fundamental scale for time and space is provided by quantum gravity. It's provided by the Planck length and Planck time. There is no other, at our level, fundamental reason. Yes?
If we say there's a correspondence between the partition function and this Hamiltonian, then what term in the IC model Hamiltonian corresponds to our kinetic term?
To Hadder?
To the term m squared over 2 del x d v squared.
The term m squared, this one?
Yes.
This one?
Yes.
Well, it corresponds to the measure, in fact, because if you think a little bit about it, remember, in the Ising model, the measure is, so in the Ising, well, let us write it here. In the Ising model, the partition function is defined by sum over Si equal plus or minus 1 for all the Si of exponential minus the beta times the energy of the Ising model for the spins. Okay? And you can write this as a measure. You can write this as a product over I, over d of Si, but simply you have a delta function which tells you that Si squared is equal to 1. So if you want, you can write this as a measure over a continuous spin going from minus infinity to plus infinity, but simply the measure in terms of the spin Si is just concentrated of minus 1, between minus 1 and plus 1. Okay? For my free field, okay, remember, I had Z, which has an integral over products over the lattices of d phi I. And if I want to make the analogy with the Ising model perfect, I put this term in the action. So I have something which is of the form exponential minus beta, some h Ising-like of phi. But then remains these terms. And these terms, I can put it in the measure because it's exponential of a sum of terms relative to the sides. So I can put it just simply by saying that this is minus m squared over 2 h bar delta x squared times phi I squared. And I decide to put this term in the measure instead of the action. You see, originally, this term was in the action, and I had a measure which was just an integral over the phi I. But you know, when you have an integral, you can decide that something, some part of it is a measure, and some part of it is a function you integrate over. So I change the definition, and if I decide that the mass term in the action is in the measure, this is simply something like a product of I, of some measure d mu of phi I, you see? And this measure is just a Gaussian measure. So if you consider the mathematical object, which is the partition function, in that way, the difference between the Ising model and the Gaussian free field in the free field is just that the measure over the spin for the Ising model is just two Dirac peaks in minus 1 and plus 1, while the measure for the free field, this measure here, is a Gaussian measure. Okay? Yes?
So that correspondence, we didn't need to discretize it, right? We could have mapped this onto a statistical mechanical model of a continuous field.
In practice, statistical models are usually defined in on a lattice because, and only in some very special case, you can take a continuum limit. because most problems of statistical mechanics come from condensed matter, and condensed matter, the degrees of freedom are attached to, you know, atoms or molecules or spins on a crystal, or in more complicated problems like in soft matter, they're attached to molecules in liquids or in colloidal liquid crystals. But there is always some size of the basic element of the system you consider, which are the atoms or the molecules or the elements in the colloid, etc. So in statistical physics, there is always a minimal distance. Okay. Okay, so now I come back to this analogy between quantum field theory, to the quantum field theory, by saying, of course, that we are interested in two limits. First, we are interested in the continuum limit. So once we have computed quantities using this path integral formulation, this functional integral formulation, eventually with the discretization, we have to go to delta x, delta tau goes to zero. And the second point is that we are interested in the thermodynamic limit. Limit in the sense of, which means that I want to consider that space becomes infinite. And I am interested in particular in the limit where p goes to infinity. So both space and Euclidean time becomes infinite. And this, as we have seen, amounts to project on the vacuum state of the theory. And those are two very different limits. You see, you may very well consider a quantum field theory living in continuum space, but still living in a box, confined. You have a quantum field which is confined in a box, and you are you may be interested in the property of a quantum field at finite temperature. And two very important examples of considering what are the properties of quantum field theory at finite temperature are physics of the Big Bang, where space was very hot and very dense, space, and the physics of collision, of heavy ion collisions, which takes place, for instance, at CERN, where people are squashing atoms, heavy atoms, together to produce very hot and dense nuclear matter for a short time, which is, of course, at a very high temperature, and to see whether a plasma of quark and gluon forms and how it evolves. So the calculation considering quantum field theory at finite temperature is of relevance for many important physical problems. It's not only a mathematical problem. OK. So now, let us go back to compute something. At the moment, I still have been doing analogies. So now, we shall be interested in computing what is called the 2 points correlation function. So the 2 points correlation function is the object that I will call phi of x, phi of y. And it is a generalization of an object we have already discussed, but at a formal level in quantum mechanics. So this is defined in a proper way as this functional integral of minus SE of phi. So I'm computing the two-point correlation function still for the Euclidean quantum theory, but simply I am inserting in the functional integral the product of the value of the field at two different points. Okay. And as I told you, we have to normalize this by the partition function. So I want to copy on this, typically with this kind of boundary condition and eventually with discretization of space-time. And the question is, how do you compute this object? And in fact, it's very easy to compute this object because this is a Gaussian integral. Remember, the Euclidean action at least in the continuum is written here, and it's quadratic in the value of the field. And since we have periodic boundary condition, that's a special case which makes the calculation very simple. Otherwise, it's a bit more complicated, but the principle is the same. You can rewrite the Euclidean action simply as the integral over your Euclidean spacetime of 1/2 of phi times an operator, which is minus the Laplace operator plus phi, where the Laplace operator is, of course, sum from mu equals 0 to d minus 1 over dx mu squared. This is the Laplace, what is called the Laplace-Beltrami operator in d dimensions. So it's just a generalization of the Laplacian of the D'Alembertian operator in any dimension. Okay, and of course, this means simply integral over d of x of 1/2 of phi of x times the function minus the Laplacian plus m squared applied to the function phi taken at a point x. See? So this is the Gaussian integral, and the action, in fact, is quadratic in phi. So it takes the form of a quadratic form. You can write it formally. This is a quadratic form. You can write it a bit formally as simply phi times an operator, which is minus the Laplacian plus m squared times phi, where this product, you know, I can write this in this way, where this is an operator acting on phi, and times phi, where this scalar product is just what is phi times phi, or more generally, phi 1 times phi 2. This is simply integral over x of phi 1 of x times phi 2 of x. So this defines what is the scalar product, and this defines what is the action of the quadratic form in the space of function. You see? And therefore, what we have to compute is simply the expectation value of two random variables. So you can consider that phi of x is a random variable. And of course, I will add the term 1/2 here. And it is a Gaussian random variable. And the probability, the weight, the probability, the distribution law for this random variable is simply exponential of minus 1 over 2 h bar times phi times this operator times phi. Okay? And I think in the first lecture you got at the beginning of this program, you have seen what are the properties of Gaussian integral. And one of the main properties of Gaussian integral is that if you have main properties of Gaussian integral, if you have a collection phi A, let us say, or A equal 1 to N, of random variables, okay, with a distribution of the form exponential of minus 1 half of phi A times some matrix, that's what's called it, KAB times phi B, where I'm summing over repeated indices. Then, so to be complete, I sum over A and B. There is a very simple calculation, so that if I want to compute the average of two of those random variables, this is simply equal to the matrix element of the inverse matrix of the variance matrix. Have you seen this theorem? Yes. Okay. Well, it's a very general theorem. Okay. And of course, what is what is K minus 1? K minus 1 is just the matrix whose product with K is equal to identity. So K minus 1 is defined by K times K minus 1 equals the identity, so which means that KAB times K minus 1 BC equals delta BC when I sum over B. This is the definition of K times K minus 1 equals identity. Okay? So this means that by this very general formula about the properties of Gaussian integrals and Gaussian random variables, we immediately know how to compute this object. And what we get is that the expectation value of phi of x, phi of y, is just the matrix element. It's just a function that I will call g of xy. And this is just the matrix element between x and y. Let us call it this, xy of the inverse of the quadratic form, the inverse of this operator. See? Now, what is this function? This function is the inverse of this operator. It means that minus the operator itself, when I applied it to the function x minus xy, and of course, then I have to take the derivative with respect to the height index x, so I take the Laplacian with respect to x of a function which is a function of x and y, I must get the analog of the matrix element of the identity function, which is just the Dirac function, delta of x minus y.
Yes? When you discretize space-time, doesn't the derivative operator connect two different points in space now?
Yes, of course, but that's precisely what the Laplacian does. Remember?
Right. But to do the Gaussian integral, don't we need our different modes to be separable?
In the Gaussian integral, the different modes correspond to the value of phi at the different point in the lattice. So as soon as the matrix K is not diagonal, then it connects different points on the lattice. You see? And since this formula is general, it's valid. And you see, the Laplacian is an operator which connects two points on space-time. Those points have to be very, very close together. But you need to know what is the second derivative of a function. So you need to know how a function varies for very, very nearby points. So this is a local operator in the mathematical language. The Laplacian is a local operator because it involves only the local properties of the function. You need to know the value of the function, of its derivative, of the second derivative, etc. But so it doesn't, you don't need to know the properties of the function far away. But it's not an ultra-local operator because you need to know the behavior of the function around the points where you consider the function. So it's local, but not ultra-local.
Okay. And so you're saying that using this, we just need to diagonalize this k without having to go to Fourier. We don't have to go to Fourier space.
Well, this is a general formula, so it's independent of any basis. So, okay, so from that you get this result. You get that this two-point function, which is called it's called either the two-point function, but it will be called also the propagator in Euclidean space. It's just a function which is satisfies this differential equation.
Is it equivalent to going to Fourier space? Or are we going to a diagonal basis going to Fourier space?
Yes. I show you this immediately. Okay. Because now you have to solve this equation.
Right.
And, there are a few subtleties that I will not explain, but basically, the best way to compute this equation, this function, is to remark, for instance, first that g of xy must be a function of x minus y because of translation invariance. Okay, here I made the statement, but you can prove it. And then, since it's a function of x minus y, you may consider its Fourier transform, indeed, as you did. You may consider that instead of considering g of x, I will consider, so let me call this z. So z, remember, is a vector. It's a vector in dimension. I will consider Fourier transform. Which is, so I define g hat of k as integral d dz of e to the power. And then I just have to be sure of whether there is a plus or minus. So I will assume, I will take the definition of mathematics, it's minus I k times x times, I'm sorry, z times g of z. Remember, k is a vector. Also, it's a yes?
I've been wondering, on the bottom board, the second equation from the top, it seems to me that that is an analogy with the sum over k sub a v, k inverse of b.
Yes, no, it's not an analogy, it's exactly the same equation. It is this equation when I consider that instead of this k, instead of it depending on a finite number of indices depends on the continuous number of indices, which are the position in space-time.
Right. So over there, we see three letters that label indices, A, B, and C.
Yes.
And down here, we have just X and Y. So I'm wondering, why is there no third indice?
Here, I can write this, that I have an operator. This operator has a kernel. So this operator corresponds to something acting on the function. So it depends, its matrix element depends on two points, and this function depends on 2z. And this object is called, this object, if I want to be precise, Z is called the kernel. The operator minus Laplacian plus m squared. And this kernel, if you walk a little bit, is simply minus the operator Laplacian associated to x plus m squared applied to a distribution which is a Dirac distribution of x minus z. So where this is a Dirac distribution, of course, in d-dimensional space, and where this is a Laplacian. So you see. So in fact, when I'm writing minus Laplacian plus m squared of g of x and y as just an operator acting of a function, and in fact, a kernel of an operator applied to a function, but this kernel in that case is just the Laplacian applied to a Dirac distribution, so it's another distribution. With support on x equals z. So it's local in that sense. So you see, I don't know if you, all of you have heard about what a distribution is. It's a mathematical object which is a generalization of a function. But which typically, for most physicists, the only distribution you need to know is a Dirac function and its derivative. But it's a very general mathematical theory which is very useful in physics. OK, so let us go back to this point. If I define the Fourier transform of g hat of k, which amounts, in fact, to make a change of basis in the space of function, then, of course, this equation here. OK, so let me go back to the old definition. OK, this equation here becomes, by standard rule of Fourier transformation, this operator in x space becomes just a function. It becomes a function k squared plus m squared in Fourier space. This becomes g hat of k. And the Fourier transform of the delta of the Dirac distribution is just the constant function. Okay, so you get immediately that the Fourier transform of the propagator takes the well-known form. This is dd of k, where there is a normalization factor 2pi to the dimension d. There is an exponential of I times k dot z, and I'm sorry, this is, I'm computing g of z times 1 over k squared plus m squared. Okay, so the propagator is a Fourier transform, or rather the inverse Fourier transform of a Lorentzian function. Okay. And this is a function that, well, either I describe its property now or I describe its property tomorrow. I think I will show what are the properties of this function tomorrow. What remains to be done is in order to show that the formalism makes sense, is that to check whether using this approach, we recover the expected result when going back to real time, because this is the formula of the propagator in Euclidean space. Remember. So, what remains to be done in order to show you the power of this formalism? Is to show that, remember here I am in Euclidean space. So x is the first component of the four vector here, if I am in four dimension, is Euclidean time, and the remaining component are the component of space, space vectors. Okay? If I want, and I'm computing interested in computing phi of x, phi of y. Okay? And let, of course, this calculation is valid. This calculation is valid when p equal infinity and l equal infinity.
Why should that be the case?
Pardon?
Why is that the case?
It's the case because otherwise, you have to replace k by a discrete k discretized. You know, if you have, it's well known. If you have a system in a box or in a torus, so if x is periodic, then in momentum space, k is quantized. It's discrete, let us say. So if you are interested in the property of the system, in a finite system, the momenta have to be discrete. Because, of course, the momenta can only be harmonics of the size of the box. And that's the reverse of something that you have learned in condensed matter. Yes?
Over there, you wrote that k is in Zd.
What did I write?
You wrote that k is in the integer vector space.
Oh, I am sorry. I'm very, very, very sorry. This is an awful misprint. Of course, k. I'm very sorry. If you got confused about that, I apologize. This was a misprint. Of course, I am in infinite dimensional space, so position is infinite, so the dual momenta are infinite. It's only when space is finite and periodic then the momenta have to be discretized. But that's exactly the reverse on what you are doing. Remember, if you have an object, if x is discrete, then you know that the momenta p are periodic. They are in a box. And this box, of course, if this is a lattice, this is called simply the Brillouin zone, something you know very well. So the mathematics are the same. OK, so let me go back here. So I'm considering this object in Euclidean space. And I am considering that p equal infinite and l equal infinite. So then, if I want to go back to Minkowski space, where x is equal to real time and x, what do I expect to get if I do the calculation from the rule I gave you last time? I expect to get, since I am for an infinite, the Euclidean time is infinite, therefore I am projecting, I'm interested in computing quantities at zero temperature. This means temperature equals zero, which implies that I'm computing, projecting on the vacuum of the theory. So what I'm computing is a matrix element on the vacuum state of the theory. of some observable. And what do I expect? I expect to compute the expectation of value of products of field operators. And remember the last rule, I expect to compute the time order product. If I do the calculation in Euclidean space, and if I want to see what this object becomes when I go back to Minkowski space, I expect to obtain the matrix element between the vacuum state of the time ordered product of products of two field operators between x and y, of course. Okay? And this is an object that you have seen in quantum theory. This is called the Feynman propagator. And since we started a bit late, I think I have time to show you that we indeed, from this result, reproduce the Feynman propagator on the form you have obtained in Kostia-Zarembos course. Okay, so let us do that. In order to go from Euclidean space to Minkowski space, remember, in Minkowski space, physical time lies on the real axis of complex time. So this is the real axis of complex time. And Euclidean time lies on the imaginary axis of Euclidean time. Okay? So we start from, if we compute this, and let us, of course, what I'm going to compute is just, yes, I'm going to compute something like that. So we start from a point where the times are there. And we want to see what this object becomes when I go from Euclidean time, so imaginary real time, to, or physical time, let us say. So I go from imaginary physical time to real physical time. And this operation is called the Vick rotation, because I'm simply, I'm doing a rotation in the complex time plane. So I consider that time is a complex variable. And when time, the variable t, is real, it corresponds to a physical time. And when it's imaginary, I'm doing calculation in Euclidean quantum field theory setup. Okay? And so you see that, let us write this object a bit more carefully. I am interested in computing g of x 0, let us say, that I will call g of x, okay, where initially I am x is tau x. You see? Okay. So then, of course, this object is given by a Fourier transform, so this is dk over 2 pi to the power d. And of course, since the position is a d-dimensional vector, the impulsion is also a d-dimensional vector. And let me call its first component k naught. And the last component, the component of an impulsion in the dual of space-time. So this is a spatial impulsion, and this is an energy impulsion, if you want. While this is time, and this is space. Okay. And then I can write this simply as exponential of I times tau times k naught plus x times k. And then I have 1 over, and what is k squared plus m squared? This is, of course, k naught squared plus the vector path of k squared plus m squared. You see? Okay, so this is the initial thing that I want to compute, which is given by this formula. This is the Euclidean propagator here. Let us write it on P Euclidean to be precise. And now I take this expression and I start to move tau. So instead of, so let me just rotate this. This is the tau axis. This is a t axis. I start from a tau here, and I want to go there. Okay? So I rotate tau by an angle which is positive, which goes from 0 to pi over 2. But if I rotate this, you see there is a problem. Because, of course, here I integrate k naught initially. In this formula, I integrate k naught. So this is what's happening. I'm interested in the Euclidean theory. I'm integrating k naught from minus infinity to plus infinity along this axis. So if you want, let us rewrite this. I integrate dk, and I integrate dk naught over 2 pi from minus infinity to plus infinity. Okay? And you see that this integral makes sense because it's a pure phase as long as tau is real. If tau becomes imaginary, so if tau is somewhere here, then the exponential is growing on one side and decreasing on one side. So the integral is not defined anymore. It's not a problem because, in fact, we are integrating over k naught. So we are free to change the contour of integration. So if we change, if we rotate tau, in order for this to still be an oscillating factor, we have to rotate the contour of integration of k like that. So if I rotate this by a factor, by an angle, let's say theta, I rotate the contour of integration in k naught by a factor minus theta. You see? And that's a free, because the Cauchy theorem ensures tells me that as long as the integral is well behaved at infinity, I am free to rotate the contour of integration. I consider that this is a complex variable. I am integrating over a contour integration. I can switch the contour of integration. Okay? And you see that if you do that, if at the end of your calculation, you end up on the real axis, namely on the real time axis. You see, we started from here, and we were here in the intermediate calculation at the end, What do we get at the end? Of course, we get a contour of integration which is like that. Okay, here now we are making an angle of minus pi over 2, while here we have made a rotation by an angle pi over 2. Okay? So now we have to integrate the k naught from plus I infinity to minus I infinity. You see? Okay. And here comes a problem. Let us let us call, of course, so in this case, let us call this k naught equal minus I omega naught, where omega is a frequency. Because if I make this change of variable, if I make this change of variables, I integrate omega naught from minus infinity to plus infinity. So this is the axis for the omega. And you see that this is a dual of the relation tau equal I t. Okay. And then you see that along the real axis in k naught, this denominator has poles. It has poles at k naught equal square, equal minus k square plus m square, of course, which means k naught equal plus or minus I square root of k square plus m squared. So in this integral, as long as I integrate over k naught and I do not integrate over k, the numerator in the integral has poles here and here. You see. And the beauty of the calculation is that when I am doing the calculation, I know I start from a contour of integration in k naught and rotate it until I get a contour of integration for imaginary k naught, which goes in that way. But since it goes in that way, you know, you turn it from there, you know that, in fact, you are avoiding the singularity like that. See? So the result of this calculation, okay, erase this, is simply that now, when x is equal to, when I make a change of variables by writing that t, that I'm sorry, that tau equal I t, the Euclidean propagator, which is a function of tau and of x, becomes the following integral. And now, instead of integrating over k naught, I integrate over omega naught. So this is d omega naught over 2 pi. I integrate omega naught from minus infinity to plus infinity. Since I made this change of variables, there is a factor minus I. I still integrate over the spatial momenta component, I have nothing changed. I still have e to the power I omega naught tau plus k times x, you see. Here now I have at the denominator k naught squared, which is minus omega naught squared plus k squared plus m squared, this and
omega zero t.
Pardon?
Exponential of omega zero t.
Here? Yeah. Is there something missing?
The omega zero t.
Oh, yes. Sorry, very sorry. Yes, of course, you're right. It's omega zero t. And now, in the omega naught plane, omega naught is just this, so I'm just rotating this again. The function, the numerator, has poles here . These are the poles, are square root of k squared plus n squared and minus square root of k squared plus n squared, where this is a vector component. And I know that my contour of integration is, if I just rotate, is this one. Okay? And you can check that this is precisely, so this contour of integration is precisely the Feynman prescription of contour of integration over the frequencies or the energies, which give you the Feynman propagator. So I indeed check that when I start from the Euclidean propagator for x minus y, and when I change, I make the weak rotation, I take the expression for the Euclidean propagator for a real Euclidean time. I start, move, I make an analytic continuation to imaginary Euclidean time, which means real physical time. And what I get is precisely the Feynman propagator, namely the matrix element in the vacuum of, or the expectation value in the vacuum state of the time-ordered product of the products of two field operators, phi at point x and phi at point y, where they are given by this x. See? Okay. So you see that those rules of functional integration plus the trick of performing this weak rotation allows you to reproduce by an analytic calculation where we didn't have to deal with operator normal ordering. So it's another way to get the correct result for the Feynman propagator of a free field. Yes?
To look at the two-point correlation function that we wrote down on the second board there. So if we take the thermodynamic limit and p to infinity, then we can relate it to QFT case where it's an average over the vacuum state.
Yes.
But if you had not taken P to infinity, how would you relate it to QFT?
Oh, so if I hadn't taken P to infinity, then I would have computed the same object, but so the same operator, the same quantum operator, but in a thermal state.
And the thermal state has temperature real with.
With the temperature related to P.
Which is then the real time in the QFT.
No. Because remember this picture I gave last time. If complex space-time at finite temperature is periodic in tau, but infinite in real time. So if you have a quantum system at equilibrium at finite temperature, time still goes on. Simply on the average, since it's at equilibrium, all the correlation functions are invariant by translation in time, because we are at equilibrium. But still, we may very well ask, what is the correlation? What is the probability to create a particle now, and that it annihilates in 1 million years, even if the temperature of the universe is very, very hot? It's 1 GeV. You see, there is no relation between the time is still infinite, so this is physical time, and this is the Euclidean time, which is a mathematical way to represent and construct and get the properties of a quantum system in a thermal state. You see? And to be more precise, remember, if we are at finite temperature, Euclidean time is periodic. Euclidean time periodic means that the associated momentum is discrete. It means that k naught here, the k naught are discrete. And it means that instead of integrating over omega going from minus infinity to plus infinity, you are integrating over a discrete subset of frequency. So time, if you want. So if there is temperature which is positive, then it means that k naught is periodic. Tau is periodic. Therefore, k naught is discrete. And therefore, in fact, it's something slightly different. K naught is discrete, and K naught is discrete, but omega naught is still continuous. It's still continuous, but you have to make some mathematics using some Poisson formula to show that there are additional singularity. Remember, k naught like that. So to say that k naught is discrete means, in fact, you have singularities along the imaginary axis, which are called the Matsubara. Frequency. So it's more subtle.
In the final expression of the continuous function,
that's what
should be omega zero t minus k dot
n. It's omega zero t minus. Okay, that's a convention. And that's basically because omega zero, so tx are the component of x mu. The component of space-time, and a vector is, I never remember, it's a covariant or contravariant. Okay. And then here, omega zero key in this notation are the k mu. And in many textbooks, one consider the component of the contravariant tensor k mu up, while this is a dual, which means that there is a change of sign. So it's a matter of first convention and second, you have to be careful whether you are considering covariant or contravariant vectors, both for the position and for the impulsion. But once you work that out, you can check that. It's a correct formula. You get the correct result. You see? So I think that indeed, this is not exactly the form you get, for instance, in Peshkin book, but that's because of that. That's because this is still a scalar product. This means that I'm taking the scalar product of k mu with mu up and of x mu with mu up, of k mu with the mu down. Pardon?
It can't
be the scalar product, so there should be a minus sign. So where do you expect the minus sign, here or here?
Inside, before k is not
here. Here?
Yeah. I mean, calculate the scalar product in the Minkowski space.
No, but even in Minkowski space, you know, in Minkowski space, k mu x mu is still k0 x0 plus kx. It is, it is, but this is minus k naught x naught plus kx, since I'm using this metric, and if you are using, like in Peskin books, this metric, this will be k naught x naught minus kx. So you have to be a bit careful. But it's a matter of convention of what you choose as a metric and whether you consider covariant and contravariant vectors. You see? I've been too long once again, so you need some rest.